welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When they want to raise money for medical research, foundations hold galas or charity walks, silent auctions, and so forth. Recently, the ALS Association has been the beneficiary of a more informal, spontaneous, and wetter approach.
One, two, three.
That's the sound of the Ice Bucket Challenge, a social media initiative intended to raise awareness and funds for the ALS Association. By now, most of you are aware of these challenges. Joining us now to talk about the disease behind the headlines and the videos is the director of the Packard Center for ALS Research at Johns Hopkins, Dr. Jeffrey Rothstein. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
That was a clip of you and your staff taking the Ice Bucket Challenge, which means dumping a freezing bucket of water over your heads. Why did you decide to take the challenge?
We're very deep members of the community, both clinically and at research level. And I think since we ultimately, as researchers, would be beneficiaries of such gracious philanthropy, we should be equally part of the effort to help raise the money.
It's raised so far about $90 million for the ALS Association, which you are not affiliated with. Do you think the increased visibility of the disease has made any difference?
Oh, sure. You know, it's not just ALS. I'm a neurologist as well as a researcher, and there are a lot of rare diseases out there, and all of which could benefit from more people knowing about them. And, of course, raising money to help fund research to eventually help patients in terms of their daily lives dealing with the disease and research to ultimately cure or slow down these kinds of diseases. So it's been a wonderful experience for ALS. For so many years, my patients have always, when they come, will often say, you know, I knew nothing about this disease, and it was the first thing I heard about it. So education is always the first step in disease management.
I'm familiar with ALS because I've known people who have been affected by it, and it's also very well known as Lou Gehrig's disease. But let's talk about ALS. What does it do to the body? What happens?
Sure. So ALS, so the medical term is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and that's really an anatomy term. It describes what part of the nervous system slowly degenerates in ALS. And ALS is just that. It's an adult onset. Generally, for almost all medical diseases, there can be exceptions, but it's an adult onset, what we call neuromuscular disease. It's a disease of the cells in the brain and spinal cord that control the voluntary movement of our muscles, meaning our arms, our legs, the muscles that keep us standing straight, hold our head erect, allow us to begin swallowing, and most importantly, the muscles that control our breathing. Now, the muscles are actually not ill in ALS. It's the cells that control the muscles. I often use a car analogy, and it's the tires. If you need tires to sort of move the car forward, tires are sort of like muscles. But if the tires don't roll, it could be that, well, they're flat or the engine's not working. And in ALS, it's really the engine that's not working and the very cells that control, if you will, the tires, in this case, the muscles.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about ALS. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Does it affect the senses, such as hearing, sight, that sort of thing?
No, so it's generally, in old sort of old textbooks, we think it is purely what we call a motor disease. It's your voluntary motor muscle. So it's not really a painful disease. It doesn't affect sense of taste, smell, seeing. It generally actually doesn't even affect thinking, except more recently we've come to understand that a small subset of patients can have some pretty dramatic effects on thinking. And there's actually an overlap with ALS and dementia.
How is it diagnosed?
So ALS is largely, if not exclusively, a clinical diagnosis, which means you ultimately make your way to an expert, usually a neurologist or even a subspecialist, just neurologist, who will make the diagnosis based on the changes in your body over time. So it's not often a disease that can be diagnosed the first day you have symptoms. And this, of course, is the challenging part of the disease for patients. It's not uncommon to take about a year to reach diagnosis. For the most part, there's no blood test for ALS. There's no imaging, X-ray or MRI or CAT scan of the brain that will tell you of ALS. We do a large number of tests to make sure it's not something else that is definitely treatable, mm-hmm. like thyroid disease or Lyme disease or many other diseases that can only partially mimic. No disease really fully mimics ALS. It's a unique-looking disease. In a subset of patients, about 10% of patients inherit the disease in their family. In those patients, we actually do have a blood test where we can detect the gene.
What are the early symptoms that people usually get that suggest something's wrong?
About 75% of patients will first have a change in their hands or feet, and that will manifest, that will show itself typically as you might trip. So this is going to sound a little sexist, but it might be a man who's middle-aged and on the golf course and will trip and fall, mm-hmm. and will notice from that point on that he's limping, but not really a painful limp, just that he can't move his leg quite as well. Mm-hmm. And he or she will often blame the fall, because as adults we don't fall too often. And over time, that foot weakness will get slowly worse, and will move from one foot, actually, say from the right foot, and slowly over time, he or she will begin to notice his left foot has a problem. And early on, the first workup, the first evaluation will be, oh, you must have a pinched nerve or something in your leg or your back. So there's for months, there's that kind of workup. The other presentation might be that a patient has trouble holding an object in their hand, and it's often first diagnosed as carpal tunnel.
Geez, I mean, does that happen more often now that so many of us are familiar with carpal tunnel?
Yes. It's and it's not a diagnostic error. It's not like the physicians out
right.
there, not that Hopkins made a mistake. I used the word before, a progressive. It begins very focally in a hand and an arm, and it slowly changes to involve more muscles. So even experts, if a patient in the community were first to show up to my office here at Hopkins with those very early signs, I couldn't make the diagnosis. It really takes time for the disease to move through the body. And quite frankly, you mentioned carpal tunnel. It's very common. A lot of people have it. And in fact, a lot of people, so a very common scenario, and I'll often teach my medical students this, is that a patient will come to the outside physician, and they'll say their hand's not working properly, they have a little trouble handwriting, they go to see the appropriate orthopedic surgeon, they actually do have a little carpal tunnel. The surgery's done. Physical therapy follows, and the patient will go back to the surgeon a month or two later and say, I don't know, maybe the physical therapy helped me, but what did you do during surgery? Because about a month later, my other hand started to give me a problem. Well, it wasn't really the surgeon. It was the earliest changes that occur in ALS. And that's a pretty typical scenario.
Is it related to other diseases?
No, yes and no. It's in a unique class by itself. It has no relationship to another disease that has sclerosis in the title, meaning multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. It is an adult onset disease, and we call it neurodegenerative because the nervous system is slowly changing. Because of the dementia, we now know that it overlaps a little bit with dementing illnesses, like a disease called frontotemporal dementia, another kind of Alzheimer's-like disease. Mm-hmm. But it actually is in its own class.
What do we know about what the disease is doing to the brain? For instance, with Alzheimer's, it's some kind of a plaque buildup. What's happening with ALS?
Very good question. So that's been obviously the focus of many years of research,
right.
as it has been in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. What's really occurring? So at one level, we know the cells that control your muscles called motor neurons, and you've got a set of these in the top of your brain called the motor cortex. That's where all the motor activity first begins, and those cells connect to another cell, set of cells called lower motor neurons in your spinal cord. Now, these are the largest cells in your body, the lower motor neuron in your spinal cord that moves your big toe lives around where your belly button is in your spinal cord. So that's a 2 or 3 or 4 foot length for a cell. So these are very large cells. These cells slowly die. And over the years, we've learned that it's not just a problem in those cells. We used to think the problem was those cells. We now know that the cells around those motor neurons, what we call the neighborhood, become ill and actually may be contributing to why those cells die. So we've begun to piece out the various steps, but we don't have a good handle on what starts the disease. Why does this all begin? And that's actually where research studying the inherited form of the disease becomes important, because in the inherited form of ALS, that is the what we call the familial form, mm-hmm. we know the genes, or some of the genes, that start the disease. So we can do a genetic test and say, my God, in your family, and your mother and your grandfather and your great-grandfather had this disease. We know it's a gene. The newest one is a very long name called C9ORF72. It's a very common mutation. And we've begun to say, well, what does that mutation do to begin to injure the cells? Those early clues give us an idea about the mechanism. And if you know the mechanism of disease, you can begin to think about a therapy for a disease.
Right, because is there much treatment now, or is it just taking care of somebody?
Well, it's a little bit of both, a little more of taking care than the treatment. So more than 20 years ago, the first drug was discovered for ALS called Riluzole, Riluzatec, and it works on a certain pathway in the brain. And it passed all the right metrics for a drug being successful. That is, a variety of clinical trials all showed it had an effect. That was good, and the FDA approved that drug, and it is the only FDA-approved drug for ALS. So that's, on one level, very good. The bad side of that, well, it's not really a bad side. The bad side to this is that it's not a very effective drug. No one gets better on this drug. We have no way of reversing ALS. So if you take this drug and you take it early in the disease, you'll live 3, 4, 5, 6 months, even maybe a year longer, but you won't feel better. And most of us, when we go to a doctor, we want to take something that actually gets us back to where we were before we got ill. And that's very complicated for the nervous system because you have a sore throat, you have an infection, you have a cut, your body can heal itself. Our brain and our spinal cord have no ability to heal itself, just the way we've evolved as human beings. So if you lose brain cells, you lose them for good. And so most of the drug discovery efforts have been trying to do one of two things. Can we slow that process down? Mm-hmm. When I see a patient, 50% of the cells that control their hand have now died. I want to keep the other 50% alive. I'd like to find a way to replace those cells, but right now that's still far beyond our technology.
Would it help if you could screen for it earlier?
So yes and no. Yes, we could. The earlier you detect the disease, almost in all cases, the better. The problem is what I told you about the kind of disease it is. It's what we call sporadic. So 10% of patients have it in their family. So those people, we can do a blood test even before they ever get ill. But the sporadic form, the term that we use for patients who've developed a disease out of the blue, what are we going to screen? Do we screen the entire U.S. population and say, you might get it? So in those patients, you can't detect the disease until they first show up to your clinic with the possibility of having a defect, that is a problem. So that gets back to that earlier question, discussion of carpal tunnel. So if a patient first shows up to their average internist, says, my hand's not working so well, even with the ice bucket challenge, he's probably never seen an ALS patient, and he's not likely to think about ALS. He's going to think about what's common, because in medicine, what's common is common. And so you go and you treat the first set of diseases. So it is a challenge, and you get at the heart of it. The earlier we learn about the disease, especially if we have powerful drugs, the better it's going to be for patients. But identifying a patient before they ever showed the disease, that's a conundrum.
Now, we have an email from Sarah who says, I can't believe ALS is genetic only 10% of the time. How do the other 90% of the people get it? And then I'm going to turn to this caller, Ken in Upper Arlington, who has a related question. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Well, thank you both. I'm enjoying your show very much. Doctor, I wanted to ask you a question. If any studies have been done to correlate the ingestion of the neurotoxins that are commonly used in our processing and growing of fresh produce, for example, are there any connections or studies being done to determine if that may be a basis for some of these neurological diseases we have no great explanations for?
In other words, environment.
Sure.
Dr. Yeah. Rothstein?
So that's a great question. And any of us, if we're honest and look back over medical history, what we thought was safe before, we later learn is not so safe.
Mm-hmm.
So I can tell you grossly, there are no general clues about something that we ingest routinely in the U.S. In part, I say that, one, there have been a lot of epidemiologic studies. There are some environmental toxins that can contribute in a small way to ALS, mostly in farmers exposed to pesticides. But the other, what I'm really getting to is that when we look at ALS worldwide, it's pretty equal around the world. Mm. There's nothing unique in the U.S. that has a higher incidence versus, say, Japan or Australia. Now, your query might still say, but gee, doesn't everyone use various preservatives? And probably the answer is yes, but I can't tell you that I know of any specific preservative that's ever been identified. That doesn't mean in the future we won't. The environmental clues from ALS are there, but weak. There's the only other environmental clues we actually know about that are a little stronger have to do with veterans of the first Gulf War, who had about a twofold increased risk of developing ALS. It was a small total number of patients. Of course, it's terrible that they were affected. Mm-hmm. And there are no real clues that came out of those studies that taught us what they were really exposed to.
How many people have ALS in the United States or around the world? What do we know about that?
Yeah, so the estimates have always been sort of set in stone as if there are about 30,000 individuals in the U.S. Mm. that have ALS at any one point in time. We don't know if they're really accurate, and more recently the CDC was given a mandate to much more accurately to try to track those numbers. The numbers in part come from those of us who see patients, but tertiary care medical centers like Hopkins, University of Pennsylvania, or where you are, Ohio State, we're only going to see about a subset, probably only about 50% of ALS patients make it to major medical centers. Mm. It's a big country. So we're not entirely sure that's that accurate. And the other reason we don't have a larger population of ALS patients is because of the nature of the disease. It's a terrible disease, and a majority of patients die within 2 to 5 years. So we don't build up a population. If we could really keep ALS patients alive and living a good life, mm-hmm. we'd have hundreds of thousands of patients based on what we know is the prevalence of ALS.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You bet.
That's Dr. Jeff Rothstein. He's the director of the Packard Center for ALS Research at Johns Hopkins. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If you're one of the 70 million Americans who, like me, suffers from a chronic sleep disorder, you'd give a lot for a good night's rest. Sleep disorders aren't resolved, however, by a one-size-fits-all approach. For many, the answer lies with a sleep study. I'm participating in one. I have my own questions, so we invited two Ohio State University experts to talk about it. Pulmonologist and sleep expert at the OSU Lung Center, Dr. Rami Kayat, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And also the manager of the OSU Sleep Lab, Danny Leivelsberger.
That's perfect.
Yay. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, who's a good candidate for a sleep study, and has anyone ever turned away?
Well, we haven't heard it asked this way before, but the prevalence of sleep disorders, as you mentioned, is increasing related to increased age and weight of the population. So we think about it as people who have likelihood of having a sleep disorder who are good candidates for a sleep study. These could be individuals who complain of sleepiness or snoring or disrupted sleep. Sometimes decreased focus during the day. They often are individuals in the middle age. They may also have cardiovascular disease, which is a very growing segment of the population of interest for sleep physicians because they have coexistent cardiovascular disease has coexistent sleep disorders requiring sleep studies to diagnose them as well.
Now, I was under the mistaken impression that I would be doing the study tonight, and Danny cleared that all up for me, that I'm actually just meeting with a doctor. So the first step is you meet with a sleep physician?
Correct. That's that's the path to get your sleep study ordered if needed. So you would have a consultation as a new patient with a sleep specialist here at OSU. We also have other doctors that direct refer to our lab. And then they'll meet with you and go over some questionnaires and do a history and physical and some symptoms. And then they will decide if you need to come for an all-night sleep study. That would be scheduled, and we don't have our patients there until 7:30 p.m.
Okay, because so. I was wondering whether they were going to feed me dinner or not, but not at all. Isn't trouble sleeping a side effect of almost every kind of disorder?
Yes.
How do you go about determining the cause of a problem just by watching someone sleep?
So the sleep study itself involves very extensive monitoring of the patient who's undergoing the sleep study, including brainwave, EEG, heart monitoring, respiratory monitoring, movement, even there's video monitoring. And it is done for the purpose of detecting specific type of sleep disorders, such as sleep apnea or movement disorders during sleep. It's not necessarily used to diagnose insomnia, for instance, or other things that the patient already knows. And, you know, this comes up sometimes when people say, I'm telling you, I'm waking up, so I already know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not why we do it. Or I tell you, I cannot fall asleep, so we already established that, but we do it to find the reason why someone wakes up a lot at night or is very sleepy during the day. And another point to this is what we look at is usually how you're doing during the day to assess your need or how much you're getting out of your sleep. So there is a great deal of concern that people bring to us as sleep physicians about the way they're sleeping, how long they're sleeping, and all that. But often the really main measure of whether you need sleep evaluation is how you're feeling during the day, if you're functioning well, if you're achieving all the goals that you set up for your day.
Hmm. Probably, I'm sure some people over time, as sleep wears, if the lack of sleep, they start to pair what they do during the day. It isn't an automatic thing.
Yes, this is a very good point, too, because there's an issue of perception, too. And very often I sit across from a patient who has severe sleep apnea, and it's clearly that they're not getting enough sleep at night from the sleep study that we did on them. And the patient, we sit there and argue it for a while, and the patient would tell me, no, I'm doing fine. I'm doing all what I need to do, because they have curtailed all their expectations of themselves, even their spouse and, you know, their work even. They rearrange so many things. And after many years of this, they don't even know what they should have been feeling like or the type of things they're capable of doing. So there is a great deal of perception issue here.
One of the questions on the questionnaire is, do you take naps? I think the question should be rephrased, do you want to take naps?
Right, do you need naps? Yeah.
You know, because I don't, or maybe one or two a week, maybe, but do I want to? Yes.
Definitely. Yeah. And that's the thing. I think the thing to stress is perception. A lot of us in our younger years do things to compensate for being tired or not getting sleep, and as we get older, it catches up with us. And as we were talking earlier, this is a test that you can't fail. And you can't trick us, because we're looking at your brain waves. We're looking at you, what you do when you sleep. So whether you come in and sleep an hour or 6 hours or 7 hours, we see exactly what you do every night. It's all perception. And a lot of patients don't understand how well or how poor they sleep.
So let's, by the way, you're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with the manager of the OSU Sleep Lab, Danny Leivelsberger, and also Dr. Rami Kayat. He's a pulmonologist and sleep expert at the OSU Lung Center. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Right now, you might have better luck going on our Facebook page and posting your question or comment there, as a suggestion. Let's walk through it and jump in, Dr. Kaya, as it occurs to you to explain why you're doing things the way you do. But Danny, can you just take us step by step? So we meet the doctor. The doctor says, yeah, I do need a sleep study done. So I'm going to show up at 7:30 at the Martha Moore Center. Tell us what happens when I get there.
So one of the most important things, I think, from the very beginning when you see the doctor is we do give you a sleep diary for 2 weeks. And just like any other part of wellness, such as diet, a lot of times we don't realize what we're actually doing versus what we think we're doing. So keeping a sleep diary is something everyone can do. That can be found on our website or by doing a Google search and writing down what time you go to sleep, what time you get up. So you can personally do a little inventory and also have that ready for the doctor when you come to the sleep lab. When you get to the sleep lab, there's some paperwork to do, and you check in with registration. And then you're brought up to your room. Our sleep lab is at OSU East Hospital, and it has all private rooms.
Okay. Which is not the Martha Morehouse where the clinic would be.
Right. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
So there's clinics.
I'm so confused.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's hard. But since we have so many clinicians and doctors, patients come to us from different locations. However, there's only one sleep lab for OSU, okay, and that's at OSU East Hospital.
Let me stop there and ask about the diary. What's the benefit of the diary? Is that as much to help a person, say, like once people quit smoking or when they go on a diet, sometimes they suggest diaries?
Yeah. It's specific for the purpose of interpreting the results of the sleep study. So the physician looks at the diary and determines, for instance, if there's some indication in it why certain, say, the sleep architecture was changed in a certain way on the sleep study, maybe indicative of decreased sleep amount previously. It also helps with the devising the treatment plan with the patient, too, because suddenly we now have that laid out 2 weeks of patient's perception of their sleep.
Okay.
You know, and that can actually help both devise a common goal, the physician and the patient. Sometimes the patient learns a lot from it too. Suddenly they can count the hours and find that they are sleeping a lot less than they think they were, and that may be the problem why they were sleepy. Maybe you're just getting 6 hours of total sleep when you're under the impression, you know, I turned off the lights and, you know, went to bed, because we tell you when you turn off lights out and we ask you to fill this out, and the time you think you fell asleep and the times you woke up during the night and when you woke up for the day. So when you add the hours together, you may find that you're sleeping more than what you think or less, and that helps aligning the expectations too for the treatment plan.
So you bring your PJs and your toothbrush.
Yep.
And, if and you medications.
Forget, and, right, and medications. Everything normal the way you ordinarily
everything normal
would spend your evening. Okay.
Yep. If the doctor doesn't want you on a certain medication, they'll let you know for that. But other than that, we want you to do your day as normal as possible. We do ask that you stop caffeine after noon if possible, because we want you nice and sleepy when you get there. You come up, you have a private room with a private bathroom. If you forget your toothbrush, we have ones for you. It looks much like a little hotel room, and we did that on purpose to try to decrease the anxiety and make our patients more comfortable. I have a very wonderful staff, highly trained, and they only have 2 patients to 1 tech. So the hookups take about an hour, because we measure everything to put on the electrodes, and so that we get the really good quality data that the doctor's going to need to make the diagnosis if needed.
Like, what do you hook electrodes up to? What are you measuring? Heart rate, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so the EEG, the electroencephalogram, or the brain waves, goes on the scalp, actually, with a type of glue that now has gotten a lot better than the earlier years of this. It's not as irritating and washes out much easier.
Uh-huh.
There is the ECG or EKG, the heart tracing. There is the respiratory belts, which are 2 belts that are worn on the chest and the abdomen. There's an oxygen monitor and some leads on the legs. And again, sometimes we like to tell our patients about what to expect, but we also need to point out that there is no reason to get too nervous about this, because almost everyone sleeps well, just as well as they sleep at home. So with all this hookup, it is not a problem to fall asleep or stay asleep, or at least get enough sleep for the sleep physician to get information to make a treatment plan.
We have an email from Nancy who asks, please address menopause insomnia. After suffering for months, my insomnia almost disappeared after I started low-dose estrogen and progesterone.
Well, that's a very common issue during menopause and after menopause, and the hormone replacement therapy has its own concerns, as you know, and I think she's well advised to discuss, and I'm assuming this was a physician prescription. It will definitely decrease the, there are also some other interventions, including cardiovascular exercise. Sometimes we do use small sleep intervention, sleep tablets, for instance, sleep-inducing medications. Sometimes certain types of antidepressants help in this case. But generally, the best solution to it is probably doing what we call a sleep hygiene as the safest intervention, really, where you try to minimize your time in bed, worry about it less, change your cardiovascular, increase your exercise time in the afternoon, which will help consolidate the sleep. Symptoms persist, and there should be also some attempt to rule out other sleep problems, because many women assume that this is just related to menopause and the hot flashes. And after many years of suffering through this, we see some patients who actually happen to have sleep apnea or some other movement disorders that need specific treatment, risk of which will increase after menopause just as much as insomnia does.
Danny Levelsberger, is there any rules about when you have to go to sleep?
That's a great question. A lot of people ask that question, and it's like different.
When is it lights out?
Oh, for the sleep test itself? Yeah, we do it between 10 or 11.
Okay.
And our sleep rooms are set up much like we want your rooms to be. The TV goes off. We take away the remote control, which upsets quite a few people.
Though? Who's having a sleep problem and knows?
Right. Well, and that's the thing.
I mean, we've heard so much about the screens and
exactly the light from the TV alone. Yeah, and that's the thing. Some of us that are having sleep issues now we blame it on medical problems, but many Americans, we've set up our bedrooms to be anything but sleep-inducing. We've got TVs and beepers and lights and computers and alarm clocks that flash the time up on the ceiling. So at our lab, it's really bad. And so we give a perfect example of what your room should be set up like. And there's no clock and there's no...
And do you wake up in the morning then?
The tech will wake you up.
Okay.
And it is kind of a myth sometimes that our employees take naps too, but it's not true. They stay up all night and watch and collect the data.
Uh-huh.
They're there for any issues. If you wake up during the night and have to use a restroom, it's not a problem. And they're there to make sure we collect all the data. And
so if
doctors.
You have to get up and use the restroom, do you have to Okay.
There's an adapter
just,
for that.
Right.
That you could just unplug it.
Yep. You carry the wires with you, just like a purse over your shoulder.
Okay.
And it's very simple.
Because that's one of those things that you really try to like not think about too much. You don't want to turn on any lights or anything like that.
Right. And I think Dr. Kayat made a perfect point. We don't want patients to worry, because this is one of the most easy sleep or medical tests you're going to have. We just need you to come and relax, and we take care of the rest.
And we do study actually a fair amount of patients with significant medical problems too, who need to use the restroom a lot and have some more monitoring issues. For example, our sleep lab studied the most in the country of patients who have left ventricular assist devices requiring batteries to support the heart, for instance. So we're always comfortable putting them in, you know, Danny and her team's hands. And so going to the restroom is not a problem at all.
I just have time for one question. So, Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning. I have a question regarding the devices that we're offered. I've been through two tests, two sleep tests. The first one was, of course, the mask unit. It was my worst experience, and later when I discovered, you know, the need and the necessity of a mask or a device, I settled into it as best I could. Then I discovered another product. I don't know if I'm allowed to mention names of things, but...
I don't care.
it was a Winx device, okay. And I heard the advertising. I contacted my doctor, and I tested it at another sleep clinic, and I slept like a baby, and I was happy with it for the past couple of years. Recently, though, I was fitted for another appliance that just fits into the mouth and draws the lower jaw forward somewhat, and right now, that's a home run. But why do they test, I guess, with just the mask and then fit you with just a mask? Why not offer you choices?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. This is obviously will require a very long answer, but I will try to be brief. So the mask you're referring to is the mask for the continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP, and that is the standard treatment for sleep apnea. That is, it's the one that's most likely to be effective, and it's been shown to eliminate the sleepiness and 100% improve the sleep apnea count, and also has effect on cardiovascular consequences of sleep apnea. So it is the standard treatment. In fact, as you probably have experienced, insurers even don't necessarily cover these other treatment modalities, and these are sort of second and third line therapies. We do offer them, and many of our patients use them, and we encourage them to do this, but CPAP remains the first line. One quick point I want to make, too, that during the sleep study, the experience you would have with using the CPAP, so the technicians are trained to try to be efficient and make use of your time. So if you're sleeping and demonstrating significant number of sleep apnea, they know that you're going to need treatment. So they come in and place this device on, and you'd have to wear it through some mask that, you know, they may have made the decision on which mask works for you pretty quickly, actually, to try to test something on. And this wouldn't necessarily be what you will end up using when you get prescribed a treatment device. There is a lot of fitting that takes place at that point.
That's all the time we have for today, but maybe a follow-up? Talk about this later on after I've gone through the experience, if I go through it, which I now know I may not, but who knows. Danny Levelsberger, manager of the OSU Sleep Lab, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Also, Dr. Rami Kayat, he's a pulmonologist and sleep expert at the OSU Lung Center. Thanks for joining us as well.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'll continue Wellness Wednesday when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 13-year-old baseball star Monet Davis became an overnight sensation at the Little League World Series this year when she pitched a complete game shutout with her 70-mile-per-hour fastball. You'd think that Monet must live and breathe baseball, but she says her dream is actually to play college basketball. Despite her recent success, however, experts say that she shouldn't be forced to choose yet. No child should at that age, they say. Joining us now is Nationwide Children's Hospital sports medicine physician, Dr. Amy Valasik. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What are the dangers of specialization in children when it comes to sports?
The specialization in sports for children bring up some pretty significant issues that we're seeing in the office. And the American Academy of Pediatrics actually put out a position statement approximately 7 years ago because we've started to see a national trend for specializing at a young age and having increased injury to bone, muscle, or tendon that has not been seen in the past from playing too often, too hard, and too much.
Are some sports more prone to specialization problems than others?
I wouldn't single out a particular sport. It is the particular mechanic that someone is doing. So whether you are a pitcher or a catcher, you are constantly using a certain arm or upper extremity to throw. And it's just a repetitive accumulation over time, too much stress on a joint.
Is it on a young joint, though? Is that different than, say, specialization as an adult?
Correct. And so what we have learned is kids are not just little adults. And as they're growing and specifically going through a growth spurt, their joints have open growth plates. And those growth plates can accumulate injury from too much stress on the joint. And so actually what our recommendation is to start specializing after puberty, towards the end of puberty, once the growth plates have closed and they become more adult-like.
Is specialization as important as the intensity of the practices or games? For example, is a moderate approach to just soccer better than intensely playing soccer and tennis?
I would say yes. Everything in moderation at a young age, specifically for the prepubescent child, a variety is much better and much more succinct. Exercising all muscle groups, and if they're age appropriate and developmentally ready, that is much better than a single focus.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how children should or should not specialize in sports when they're younger. My guest is Dr. Amy Velasik. She's a sports medicine doctor at Nationwide Children's Hospital. We do have time for a question or two if you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. What parts of the body are important to build up as children grow? Should they worry about muscle development or flexibility or coordination as children?
Yes. So as children, I think it goes back to the basics, is learning proper development of running, jumping, landing, cutting, and using their muscles in single control. And so it goes back to just basic childhood normal development. Yes.
When someone is just exercising, say someone who does a boot camp or someone who runs every day or something like that, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're equipped to play a game of soccer.
Correct.
It's different when you're out there on the field, isn't it?
Correct. Yes.
What's happening?
I think what we're seeing nationally as a trend is you're on the field three nights a week for one team, two nights a week for another team, as well as weekend tournaments and showcases. And so children are being pushed too much, too hard, too often, and not having adequate days off per week or months off per season for rest.
You said that the message went out 7 years ago,
mm-hmm,
that specialization can be dangerous. What's your observations about whether or not coaches and parents and kids are paying much attention to that?
My observation is that folks have not heard or are following the recommendation. We are still seeing quite a number of kids. I would say majority of clinics are at least half of kids with overuse injuries at a young age.
I'm going to put Pam from Columbus on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Pam, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi.
You said your son is 11, he's active, he's having knee trouble. Does he specialize in a sport?
Actually, he doesn't, but it seems like any sport that he starts to get into, he just has this ongoing, it's just slight knee problem, and it gives out on him every once in a while, but the more active he is, the worse it becomes. But he's really good at, you know, all of the athletics that he's in, and all of his coaches want him to pursue, but it just seems to debilitate him a little bit. Like, he just stops after it starts hurting.
Dr. Velasik?
Yes. I have a couple questions for Pam. Pam, is he, did this knee pain just start recently?
It's been more recent, yes.
Okay.
Seems like he's grown quite a bit in the last year.
Yes, that's what I would suspect. So typically, as kids are going through growth spurts, their muscles and bones, their musculoskeletal system is imbalanced or off balance. It's not as if they were 8 or 6 or 5. And so retraining the muscle groups with conditioning, with stretching, typically is all kids need at this age group. And I would say what you're describing is a very common problem that once it's addressed, he should be able to pursue his athletics as he chooses.
Okay. Great. That sounds great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Is there any difference between girls and boys, do we know, as they develop when it comes to this issue?
There's slight different stages in development, yes, but we are seeing actually more overuse injuries in females than males in this age group.
That's interesting. Why do you think that is?
I don't think we have a clear-cut answer, and I believe there's ongoing research of trying to figure out what makes a female early adolescent or female child more predisposed. We definitely don't have the answer for that.
When we're talking about the physical dangers of specialization, that isn't per se what we think of as an injury necessarily, is it?
No. Yeah. No, not at all. The specialization is more a young child that is focusing on one sport, 4 seasons throughout the year, no time off throughout the year, playing on multiple teams, maybe 0 to 1 day off a week. That's what I would consider specialization. And we are seeing that much younger at the ages of 8, 9, and 10.
And some sports are year-round now.
Correct.
So there's a lot of pressure.
There's an extreme amount of pressure. And again, going back to the American Academy of Pediatrics, we know scientifically it is better for children to be have a well-rounded multiple sport approach at a young age. It offers better development of joints and muscles. And so playing a single sport per season is a much better and safer way to go.
Phil in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I wanted to tell a story about my being a junior high volleyball coach and having a girl pulled off the team by her parents so she could pitch. She could continue to pitch softball all winter. And I was really worried about her. And when I lived in Logan, Katie Smith was going through high school, and she's a great example of why you don't need to specialize.
The great OSU basketball player.
Yes. She was, besides basketball, she played volleyball and won 2 state field events. And so there's the myth that you need to specialize in the first place. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you.
And I would agree with Phil. I think the culture is trending that more is better, and that is absolutely not the case. And I'm hoping to get that message out through your show today.
I'm going to put a mic from Upper Arlington on the air. You're concerned about football damaging young kids. But is that an issue, Dr. Valasek, of overuse, or is it more a function of the type of sport it is? Mike, am I covering your question?
Well, the thing I'm concerned about is, you know, when I was a kid, we started in the 6th, 7th grade. You know, and a lot of us are paying for it today.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we played on through high school and some college, so on, blah, blah.
It goes on for a long time.
I see these kids in these little, in these bitty league football leagues, and, you know, their skeletal makeup, is, in my opinion, is very, it's very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the things we see with head trauma, I mean, do people, I mean, really think their kid's going to make the pros, or are they just going to do this to their children.
All right. Well, hang on, Mike. Dr. Valasek, is that a function? Are those concerns about overuse, or is that the nature of that particular sport?
Football is it's the nature of the sport. It is a tough sport to play, and starting at a younger age when they're not musculoskeletally ready for the trauma that is the contact that is inherent in the game, mm-hmm. It puts them at risk. However, I would say also, getting back to Mike's point, statistics have shown that no matter what sport you want to pick, typically only 0.2% of high school athletes make it to the professional level. And so it's a very select group that actually go on into college and then post-college athletics. And having the expectations for that at ages 5, 6, 7, and 8, I think, are setting kids up for some significant injury.
Is there any studies, or have you come in contact with any kids that are, it's not necessarily their bodies that is suffering the damage from the specialization, but just mentally, they're just overwhelmed by a sport?
Absolutely. We are seeing burnout, is what we would call it in our field, in children, of just fatigue. They're not living up to expectation. The emphasis on fun and sportsmanship is not necessarily there. It's more on development of a single skill, which perhaps they're not developmentally ready for.
Now, we had the caller, and you said it's very common at the age of 11 for her son to be having sort of these knee problems. He's growing and that kind of a thing. Do you see kids coming in who are having problems that you're saying, well, there's not really a problem, and you're wondering if it's psychological?
I typically would follow that over time. Mm-hmm. That is definitely not something I come across as a single visit.
Gotcha.
And as I get to know the patient or the family, the story begins to unfold sometimes, yes.
You made the point, just 0.2% ever make it to the big leagues. Can a kid ever really get good at a sport if he or she doesn't focus solely on it? We hear a lot about the Tiger Woods, the Williams sisters, the great tennis players. Did it hurt them to play just one sport?
It doesn't hurt to play one sport. It depends on when you start.
Okay.
And so if you're starting at age 5, that's going to be, you are going to be less likely to make it.
Okay. All right. Well, Dr. Amy Valasek, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Amy Valasek, she is a sports medicine doctor at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus. Thanks for listening today on Wellness Wednesday. Thanks for the All-Side staff as well. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, who produces Wellness Wednesday as well, and production assistants with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.